Peggy Meehan is a good hostess.
You want some fruit salad?
I say no to the fruit salad. I'm not sure why. I'm meeting Peggy for the first time at her apartment in a fourplex group home in Robbinsdale. It's an older suburb of Minneapolis.
Shall we sit down? Yeah, let's sit down.
We're sitting at Peggy's kitchen table. Her older sisters, Fran McCloskey and Terry Vellner, are here too. The three women were raised in upstate New York, Syracuse, but migrated to Minneapolis over the years since the 1980s. When I asked Fran to describe Peggy, she threw out these three words.
Spunky, fighter, princess.
Here's what Peggy says about herself.
I want to do more different things I want. Yes. When I was 4 years old, I want to be self-advocate of my life. I believed I want to be strong, powerful, for to be heard. And that's my belief.
Peggy's got an extra T sound, speech tick. She's also got a blinking tick. She squishes her brown eyes a lot, usually while wrinkling her nose. Peggy's 40 years old and just about 5 feet tall. She's in a constant battle with her weight, currently hovering at about 170 pounds. She wears her coarse brown hair in a chin-length bob with bangs. She's supposed to wear glasses, but most of the time she forgets to wear them.
Okay, show you my book.
Great. We're just about to start flipping through a thick scrapbook with decades worth of memories. Peggy's life with her parents, her sisters, friends, their brother Rick, who died. He was born developmentally delayed with cerebral palsy. Rick was institutionalized his whole life.
Do you remember him?
Yes.
Peggy's face turns noticeably sad. I wonder if Rick died recently. Sister Terry answers.
January 31st, 2001.
Peggy's eyes well up with tears. She's thinking about Rick, and she obviously has been transported somewhere to a sad and dark place. Fran explains.
Sometimes grief is hard for Peggy, particularly, you know, when someone close to her passes away. And it's very difficult to process those emotions for her. And so even people that have died more than 10 years ago, it still is on her heart.
Peggy has Down syndrome, and there's a stereotype about people with Down syndrome that they're happy all the time. Peggy's not like that. She's being treated for depression, and she expresses a full range of emotions, just like anybody else. In fact, she's probably more emotional than most people. Her moods are transparent, changing moment to moment. You can easily see how she's feeling just by looking at her face, her changing expressions. We all keep talking, looking through Peggy's scrapbook. We find an old newspaper clipping with a photo of young Peggy exiting a school bus.
You were just as happy as can be. Do you remember your lunchbox?
I remember the lunchbox I had.
Who was on that one? Do you remember?
Terry and Fran are prompting Peggy with details from that day.
Do you remember that?
I do.
What year was that, Peggy?
The year was 1978.
The article was about inclusion, and it was in kindergarten, and Mrs. Cool was taking you off the bus, and it was about integrating when you were able to go to school and be in class with everybody else. Do you remember that? That was fun.
It was fun.
Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, Terry asks me to stop recording.
Marisa, can we pause for just a second?
I press the pause button.
Yeah. So I also want to ask. So
we're back on, and Peggy is taking deep breaths on Terry and Fran's instruction.
On tape, or is
mostly because I didn't know what else to say, but I want Peggy to be able to take that deep breath. I think that you.
Terry's talking to Peggy now.
You didn't seem yourself, and we talked about some of that emotional stuff with Rick right away. Yep. I just wanted to make sure that you felt comfortable with the way that it was all happening, because it is like, oh, there's a big black microphone in my face, you know?
Okay.
It could make somebody nervous.
Yeah.
Even your sisters.
Peggy is a grown woman, but her older sisters still protect her, look out for her, just like they did on her first day of kindergarten. Though Peggy is 40 years old, developmentally, she's much younger, kind of like a teen or a young adult who's still learning a lot about life. That's why a whole team of people look after Peggy every day, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, to help her with everything from daily tasks, she's learning crockpot cooking these days, to keeping on schedule for work and her personal training sessions at the YMCA, and even putting together this scrapbook we're looking at now, which stops at 2005. One of the entries catches my eye.
It says that you always wanted to be a model and go to Hollywood.
Yes, that's always my biggest dream. Supermodel.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think now? Is that still your dream?
Yes.
What's happening with that?
I'm still working on it. Yeah. I just want to do that for my new job. Yeah.
Good way to make money.
Make more money and, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talking with Peggy, I'm intrigued by the certainty she invests in her dreams. It makes me question my assumptions about what's possible for anybody. Peggy goes for what she wants. When Peggy dreamt of being an actress, she persuaded her sisters and advocates to help her join Interact Theater in Minneapolis. She performed in a few plays, but she got tired of it. Too much drama, she says. Too many people having seizures, she says. A few years ago, she got interested in a group aimed at empowering people with disabilities called Advocating Change Together. So Peggy joined the board, and now sometimes she gives speeches. She gives voice to her hopes and dreams and goes to conferences advocating for people with all kinds of disabilities. Other dreams have also run their course. She was a Girl Scout. She won a Special Olympics medal for floor hockey in the 1989 International Games. She took some classes at a college in her hometown, Syracuse. Though I had said no to her offer of fruit salad when I arrived, Peggy decided I should have some anyway. So she took a little Ziploc container, she filled it with fruit salad, and she put it in my sound equipment bag. I discovered it on my way out.
Say goodbye and drive carefully.
Thank you, I will.
All right. Bye.
I'll see you.
I wanted to know what Fran and Terry make of Peggy's dream to be a supermodel. So I met up with them at Fran's house in an upscale South Minneapolis neighborhood on a street lined with leafy trees and large brick Tudor homes. Fran and Terry have been Peggy's guardians since Peggy moved to Minnesota from Syracuse in 1997. That's when their parents retired to Arizona.
Peggy is entitled to dream whatever she wants to dream.
That's Fran. She's 51 years old, and she works as a forensic accountant. She's married with two children. She says there's a delicate balance to helping Peggy feel like her life and dreams are moving forward.
Even though she might not be a supermodel in the terms that the world might view a supermodel, there are ways that Peggy can feel good about herself and be a model. For example, we went to a luncheon and they had a fashion show, and Peggy was a model in the fashion show, and she was hot stuff. She just was so proud and felt so good about the clothes that she was wearing and walking the ramp and feeling like she was an important person. And so you never want to take away the dream. You look for ways to find a manifestation of the dream where she can feel like she's accomplishing something and she's achieving some of the dreams.
And I think there's also that balance, you talk about that delicate balance of that piece. And the other part is communicating with someone who has a disability.
That's Terry talking now. She's 44 years old and a married stay-at-home mother of four. She was once a lobbyist and an aide to former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty.
You can talk about all the structure, all the support, and all these different things and the things that you need and the practical part of how maybe, Franny and you and I might have a conversation. But when she says, I heard that, but I want to be a supermodel, how much did she hear? How much did click in? How much is the reality for her? So it's hard to have those conversations sometimes, and you have to really be smart about it. And we're not always that smart about it. We need a lot of help from our staff, from a social worker, or from other people that can give advice and support her as a community in making those decisions.
And here's such a key point to understanding Peggy's daily life and how it regularly clashes with her dreams. The group home where Peggy lives is called an intermediate care facility. She has around-the-clock staff who provide her and eight other developmentally disabled adults with food, transportation, and social supports. So everything, from what she can eat for dinner, to when she can go grocery shopping, to where she lives and works, they're all decisions that take time, that have to be vetted by a team of family members, caseworkers, advocates, and sometimes a healthcare provider. Fran says the only thing Peggy truly has control over is her thoughts and her dreams. Sometimes Peggy believes if she just desires something, she'll get it. She doesn't always notice the tightly controlled parameters that shape the kind of life she has in her group home. So you could say Peggy lives in a kind of invisible bubble that limits her. Her magical thinking bumps up against it sometimes. Still, Peggy is ardent about her dream of being a supermodel. She talks about it a lot. But she also talks a lot about a couple of other things she wants to do. She wants to get a different, better-paying job than the one she has now, assembling ceiling ring kits in a sheltered workshop. And Peggy also really wants to move out of her group home and live on her own. Peggy's team, her sisters, her advocates at her group home, her county and job placement caseworkers, they're all listening to Peggy, but there's no quick or clear path to achieving her goals. But consider how far Peggy has come. To even entertain and achieve some of her dreams represents a significant shift in how people with Down syndrome see themselves, as well as how they're viewed by the larger community and medical establishment. For example, if Peggy had been born in 1930, her life would have turned out very differently. The estimated life expectancy for babies born with her genetic condition would have been between 9 and 12 years old because of institutionalization and health factors associated with Down syndrome, like congenital heart disease. Today, changing attitudes and advancements in pediatric cardiology mean that babies born with Down syndrome can expect to live at least into their 50s, 60s, and 70s, or just 10 years shy of an average adult without Down syndrome. Peggy was born in 1973, in the wake of the civil rights movement and on the cusp of changing views about people with disabilities and Down syndrome. But as liberating as the 1970s were, some members of the medical community still held on to less progressive views. Peggy's older sister, Fran McCloskey, tells her mother's chilling but common story about the doctor's reaction to Peggy's birth in a hospital in Syracuse, New York, in 1973.
She tells the story that she was in labor, and then the baby was born, and then she saw that, like, the nurses frowned, and the doctor kind of had a little frown on his face, and she was half awake, so not really fully able to express herself in that moment, but she was really concerned about what was going on, and she said, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" And they didn't want to say. And then they took Peggy out of the room, and they were trying to get a hold of my father because my father was out of town. But then the doctor came in and said, "Well, this is really upsetting to me, but the baby is a mongoloid." And my mother said, "What the hell is that?" And he said, "Well, the baby has what's called Down syndrome." And he said, "I think she should be sent right to an institution." My mother said, "Well, absolutely not. We have these two daughters that are at home waiting for a baby to come home. You know, she needs to come home and go home with us." And that was the beginning.
Did you catch the word the doctor used to describe Peggy? Mongoloid. At the time, it was also considered acceptable to use terms like Mongol idiot and feeble-minded to describe people with Down syndrome and developmental disabilities. The term mongoloid was contrived by John Langdon Down in his paper from the mid-1800s titled Observations on an Ethnic Classification of Idiots. Down is the physician credited with identifying mongolism, what would come to be called Down syndrome, by observing a subset of European patients he worked with as superintendent at the Earlswood Asylum for Idiots in Surrey, England. In his paper, Down describes how the physical features of these people reminded him of East Asians from Mongolia. He wrote, "There can be no doubt that these ethnic features are the result of degeneration." Degeneration, in this context, refers to Victorian ideas linking ethnicity with intelligence and levels of humanity. According to Down's observations, the Caucasian degenerates into the more primitive Mongoloid race. It was hard for the medical community to shake this offensive proto-eugenics concept, so the term mongoloid endured for generations.
I'm interested in knowing how you can tell a child like this is retarded.
Well, we have...
In this educational film from 1952, producer Ray Stewart of WOI-TV in Ames, Iowa, is interviewing a Miss Elsie Seymour, a staff psychologist at the Woodward State Hospital and School in Iowa. Miss Seymour is showing him a variety of mentally deficient types, including the mongoloid.
The next one is that I can show you is a little Mongolian, little Sandra.
5-year-old Sandra walks in the room.
Come over here, Sandra, will you please?
You want to stand right here?
Right
by
over
me?
Here.
Sandra wears her hair in a short bob and bangs. She's wearing a dark dress with puffy short sleeves and a white collar. Miss Seymour pulls little Sandra up by her armpits and onto her lap because little Sandra is reluctant to stand where she's supposed to. Then Miss Seymour takes Sandra's hands and moves them like a marionette while she explains the physical stigmata of the mongoloid.
The rather small head, the depressed nose bridge, and the tongue is rather large or else it's pointed. And the hands are spatulate, and the little finger curves inward, and very sharp, stubby hands, and there usually is a crease, deeper crease than usual, across their hands.
Well, what is the standard? I mean, by what level of intelligence?
Well, most of them are at the imbecile level, and this little girl is. They're rhythmical, they love music, and they mimic people.
Mm-hmm. Now, and then what another type is?
Well, another type is the cretin, which is due to a lack of thyroxin.
By the late 1960s, the term mongoloid started falling out of favor, and in the 1970s, children with Down syndrome were deemed not just trainable, but educable. The civil rights movement and liberation movements of the 1970s empowered parents like Peggy's mom and dad to become de facto activists. Like other parents around the country, they said no to institutionalization and began demanding inclusion in the schools and better social and medical supports. Some even took on the institutions, and in a wave across the country and in Minnesota, institutions started to close, and they were replaced by group homes, like the one Peggy lives in today. As a child of the 70s, Peggy is part of a first generation of children with Down syndrome to be mainstreamed into schools, paving the way for today's generation of parents and people with Down syndrome who continue to demand greater inclusion and acceptance in the community. Here's Peggy's sister, Fran.
Peggy has never felt handicapped, okay? And I use that word purposefully because to me, handicapped really has a meaning of being limited in your abilities. And Peggy has always wanted to keep up with her peers, keep up with her sisters, keep up with the Joneses, travel the world, be an actress, live where she wants to live.
The medical diagnosis of Down syndrome refers to the existence of an extra 21st chromosome. Typically, the human body has two sets of 23 chromosomes for a total of 46, but people with Down syndrome have one extra for a total of 47 chromosomes. In 2013, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention calculated the Down syndrome population in the United States as lower than previous estimates. Using both birth and death information, the CDC found that as of January 2008, there were about 250,000 people in the U.S. living with Down syndrome. Each year in the U.S., an average of 6,000 babies, or about 1 in 700, are born with Down syndrome. It's estimated that about 70% of pregnancies are terminated after a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome. However, the number of babies born with a genetic condition has been rising since the early 1980s. That increase is attributed in part to a higher number of older women having babies. There is a statistical correlation between mothers aged 35 and older and a risk of Down syndrome. Down syndrome is the most common chromosomal disorder in the United States. But how Down syndrome comes to be, why there are three 21st chromosomes instead of two, still remains a mystery. Medical and developmental concerns linked to Down syndrome include gastrointestinal problems, learning delays, speech impairment, low muscle tone, vision and hearing problems, and slow metabolism. Today, at least half of all babies with Down syndrome are born with congenital heart disease. Peggy doesn't have heart disease, but like most people with Down syndrome, she's overweight and she has several of the common medical concerns associated with Down syndrome, including challenges with expressive speech, cognitive delay, and she wears glasses and a hearing aid. As the population of people with Down syndrome ages, they become susceptible to developing Alzheimer's disease. At one point, doctors were saying there's a 100% correlation between Down syndrome and Alzheimer's. But today, the risk is considered to be much lower, about 30 to 50%. That doesn't mean that Peggy will develop dementia. And at 40, she's not showing any signs of it. It's 10 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, and I'm back to see Peggy at her apartment. Peggy's sister Fran and I arrive at the same time.
Like they're running the vacuum in here. It could be.
We're here for a meeting to discuss Peggy's health and goals.
Oh, hi, Peggy.
Peggy's whole team is assembled in her living room. Her sister Fran, her advocates from Living Well Disability Services, the company that owns and runs the group home she lives in, a nurse, and her county and job placement caseworkers.
Just finishing up getting ready and cleaning up, and we're going to get started here soon.
There's talk about Peggy enrolling at Dunwoody College of Technology in Minneapolis for a certificate program in office work. The Dunwoody certificate could mean leaving her workshop assembly job, where she makes about $3 an hour, for real work, out in the real world. It's an exciting prospect for Peggy. She could make more money and have more responsibility, all the things she craves. She has had a few real jobs before.
We just have to think through the risks.
That's Fran.
She had, in the past, some jobs similar to that, where she was in a department with all different kinds of people. She wasn't in an enclave type of setting. And that generally went really well, except for a few behavior difficulties surrounding food.
Turns out Peggy took her coworkers' food several times. She got fired for that. Stealing is an ongoing problem for Peggy at work and at home. She's been known to roam around the group home, break into people's kitchens, and, yep, steal their food. The thing is, she always gets caught. Peggy sees a psychologist about it, and she's working on changing her behavior. But, man, does she love mayonnaise. For a while, stealing mayonnaise was her thing. Anywhere she could find it. Peggy talks about it with her team, how she had amassed 40 packets of mayonnaise at one point.
40 packets of 40. Mayonnaise.
Why, Peggy?
I wanted to dip all my food, including my pretzels.
She had enough mayonnaise to dip for several years.
Everybody in the room knows Peggy and her harmless foibles. They worry about her. They love her. They have faith in her. For Peggy, the number one thing she wants to talk about at this meeting is moving out. She tells the group she knows of a place nearby where she can live. It's only $800 a month. While self-advocates would like to see more people with disabilities living on their own, with a la carte services available to them, as opposed to around-the-clock care in group homes, it's unclear how soon that evolution will take place. Affordable housing, waivers from Medicaid, and a higher-paying job all have to line up before Peggy would be able to move. Peggy hears all that, but still she announces she's got her bags packed.
Bags are packed, and all my things are totally packed.
The group responds to Peggy's optimism with cautious support, but it's time for a reality check. Peggy's advocate and daily companion, Rita Makinich Hastings, reminds Peggy that she needs to learn a lot more ILSs, or independent living skills, before she can live on her own.
First of all, you have to have an income stream. You have to be able to budget. You have to understand how to pay bills on time. You have to learn how to do life without somebody standing there all the time telling you how to do it.
House manager Adam Pfefferman asks Peggy how she'll pay her bills when she's living on her own. Peggy tells him she'll pay her bills online.
Doing bills online.
How are you paying the bills?
She's missing the part about where the money will come from.
No, not online. Doing it with my checkbook.
So how are you getting money to put in your checkbook?
It's Peggy's lack of awareness and magical thinking that make it necessary for her to have a team of people watching out for her. to protect her from some of the basic risks of life, like spending too much money or eating too much mayonnaise or meeting up with untoward people. Fran says Peggy is strong, but she's still vulnerable, even at 40 years old. She still needs protection while she learns about things people without developmental disabilities naturally learn over time. After the meeting is over, Fran and I stick around, and I go hang out with Peggy in her room. Yeah.
Okay, let's do that. Did you clean your room?
Yes, I did.
Next to her bed, I see a CPAP machine and a mask that she wears at night to help her sleep apnea, another common ailment for people with Down syndrome. There's some bowling trophies on her dresser. She's got a computer. She likes to play solitaire on it and watch DVDs of her favorite TV shows, like The Jeffersons, Beverly Hills 90210, and Melrose Place. I learned that Peggy loves Whitney Houston. It's the only music she has on her iPod. On the way out of her room, I notice she has a wall calendar near her desk. Just about each day has a sticker on it and staff initials.
What is this chart here?
The chart is being really good. Not to steal, not to be rude. Yeah.
When it's time to go, Fran and Peggy stand close to each other side by side. They're staring into each other's faces, sweetly relaxed, smiling. They squeeze each other gently and talk about getting out for bowling or a night at the dinner theater. They're emotional, but giddy with the rush and ease of a long, complicated, but loving relationship.
You have a good life, don't you, Peg?
I do.
I'm glad you live close to me. I'm an old softie. I got that from Dad. Oh, my goodness. So I was trying to make it through this whole visit without crying, but it's hard. Because I'm really proud of you, Peggy. You've made such a good life. Really, really good life.
Yes.
One thing Fran and Terry want you to know about Peggy is that she's the exception, not the rule. They say not all people with Down syndrome are like Peggy, with resources and a team of champions to watch over her. As ambitious and high-functioning as Peggy is, she's been able to go the distance because her staff and her sisters, self-described zealous advocates, are with her every step to ensure she has the best life possible. The last time I checked on Peggy, Fran told me their father died. He'd been sick, and Peggy's been having a hard time since he's been gone. Peggy completed the office training program at Dunwoody, but she's back at her job assembling ceiling ring kits for about $3 an hour. She's still stealing food, still dreaming of being a supermodel, and still hoping to someday move out of her group home and live on her own. For KFAI, I'm Marisa Helms. Miniculture on KFAI is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.